på.
Okay, right here. Who wants to? Good. Me. First question.
Hello, Dr. West.
How you doing there? Good to
see
you.
It's nice to see you again. I haven't seen you since I was working on my doctorate at Northwestern with Linda Thomas, Dwight Hopkins, and Rosemary Ruther.
Absolutely.
How are you?
Good to see you.
It's very nice to see you. Yes, I teach at Cal State Long Beach.
Okay.
And that's my question. I'm teaching a course called Christianity and Global Ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And could you tell me, I think I'm going to change one of my books, and I'm going to put yours in there.
Well, you read it through first, see what you think.
Yes, yeah, I'm going to do that.
No, that's good, though.
Number one, and number two, my question is really simple.
Yes.
In a class of that ilk, could you tell me three or four things that you would teach those students? The class is entitled Christianity and Global Ethics, and how would you work in your text and, you know, like 4 points?
4 points.
Yeah,
I mean,
one
is that the internationalism of the prophetic tradition is very, very important. And this is true even in Hebrew scripture itself, right, that Hosea and Amos and the others, they're engaged in prophetic activity to all the nations. So there's an internationalism, there's a universalism that is suspicious of any kind of idolatrous versions of tribalism, nationalism, slices of humanity, and so forth. That's very important because the most powerful ideology of the modern period, one could argue, is nationalism. And yet we're now in a moment where we have to be able to shatter forms of nationalism to be in contact with the humanities of others. And the nationalist ideology can be easily used in truncated patriotic ways that makes us think that somehow the lives of one group, one slice of humanity is better than another slice of humanity. So the internationalism, the universalism, and then talk about structures and institutions. There, of course, you're going to need some social theory, history, and so forth and so on. But it sounds like a wonderful class. Go right ahead.
There's a mic over here as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I just want to say, I want to thank you for your leadership. My question has to do with rapture politics. Bill Moyers gave a speech this week, and he basically said, do not underestimate this group that believes the events unfolding, giving them all the evidence that they need, that it's on, that it is coming. And do not underestimate their influence on the White House. And he gave evidence of that. I just want to ask, how do I engage with people who believe that I am going to hell because I'm an Irish Catholic living in Hollywood? That's my question.
No, I appreciate the question. No, I do. I was going to ask you about you defining that rapture part. We're talking about a strong slice of the Christian right who has an apocalyptic vision in which they believe, in fact, that all Jews must be collected in the Middle East as the stepping stone for the second coming of Christ and the rapture on the way, taking up just them and their friends. Because, I mean, there's a whole lot of fellow Christians like myself who they think I'm going down, too.
Does John Ashcroft believe that it's coming? I mean, president believe that it's coming?
Well, we know that, you know, Bush and Ashcroft have been deeply influenced by certain strands of that evangelical Christianity that allow for that kind of premature judgment. I mean, Christians all around the world, past and present, have believed in a second coming and so forth. It's just that they don't feel as if they have special access to the details of the timing. I mean, that's what's dangerous. I mean, you see what I mean? Because, I mean, religions have a whole host of things held up. I mean, most of our Jewish brothers and sisters of Judaic faith are still waiting, right? Now, it might be like Samuel Beckett's waiting for Godot. For the Christian Jews and everybody else. But they're still preparing. But they don't believe, they think they know exactly when and they can work it out. And then Revelations itself becomes a kind of scientific text of predicting the future. See what I mean? Now, that's dangerous. But that's been around for a long time. That's been around for a long time. You had thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans believe that the world was coming to in 1871. Right? And people lined up all around the country. So the question is, how do we ensure that that doesn't become part of policy, basis of policy, but that's going to be around, and we have to acknowledge the fact that, what is it, 80% of American citizens view themselves as Christian, 97% believe in God, 72% believe in second coming of Christ, 49% speak regularly on intimate terms with God at least 3 times every 2 days. And this is serious. I mean, this is very important for secular brothers and sisters to understand. You see, and this is one of the reasons why prophetic dimensions of Christianity and the other religions becomes indispensable. And the issue becomes, how do we ensure that, you know, if Ashcroft believes, let's have a debate about this. Congressional committees, public committees, organized, mobilized, and so on, you see. But they, I mean, there's no guarantee of it, but we have to point that out and talk about what the deleterious consequences would be. Absolutely. But look at John Kerry's problem with the Catholic Church. He is Catholic. And some of the priests still won't give him communion over the abortion issue. You see? So that what happens, I mean, it's very interesting because so much of the Christian right was a direct response to Martin Luther King Jr. That once he organized prophetic religious folk, you got a white backlash against it. And the white backlash then tied to corporate elites, tried to bring in with big money the Christian right. And you had three pillars. You got deeply, those who I call Constantinian Jewish brothers and sisters. That is to say, the deeply conservative Jewish folk who believed that the only way you could defend Israel was to support conservatives. You had 35% of Jewish brothers and sisters voted for Reagan in 1980. That's unprecedented. Because Jews are the one group that vote more for Democrats than any other group other than black people. Right? So you got deeply conservative Jews, corporate elites at the top, and Christian right all together. That's what's so fascinating about the Mel Gibson film. Because you got tension within that block. That the Christian evangelicals who have always harbored very deep anti-Semitic proclivities, if not outright beliefs, in the same block with Jewish brothers and sisters of a conservative sort. And the conservative Jewish brothers and sisters said, oh my God, my allies are putting forward a film that's deeply anti-Semitic because they are exonerating the Roman imperial elites of the crucifixion of Christ, and the claim of Jews murdering Jesus is the source of one of the ugliest crimes against humanity. Anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. And Mel Gibson said, well, I'm just following the story. But they're part of the same block. I mean, I got treatments of this in the book, but I just mentioned this because religion and politics now begin to spill over in a variety of different ways. Got a question? Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you so much for coming, Dr. West. Aaron T. with T's Independent Soul, where we focus on art, politics, and culture through the filter of soulful music.
Right on.
But this issue of Christianity is blowing my mind, and I'm curious if you could speak to whether or not the Christian right and those that kind of fall into that block understand that the Christ that they worship has actually become the exact opposite of the Christ that whipped the money changers out of the temple.
That's true. That's true, though, brother. Well, I like that question. I like that. And in fact, I mean, the chapter I call The Crisis of Christian Identity in America, I talk about the fact that the cross, of course, is the dark side, the night side of the Roman Empire, and how ironic it is that 400 years later, with Constantine's conversion to Christianity in 312, he decriminalized in 313 with the Edict of Milan, and then Theodosius I, who was his successor, makes Christianity official religion of the Roman Empire, but that's the empire that put Jesus to death. That's what I mean by Constantinian Christianity. So here we now have the American Empire and the dominant Christian forms. And you think of the imperial sensibilities of so many of our Christian churches. Because see, the paraphernalia of empire, what? Power, status, might. And that's more and more the features of our Christian churches. They got to be big, got to be mega, you got to have might, you got to have a lot of materialistic evidence to show that you're blessed. You get a gospel of prosperity, you get a spin the wheel of fortune prayer, let's make a deal with God prayer. The blood at the cross becomes Kool-Aid. Everybody just want to dip in them so they can run faster in the rat race rather than sacrifice themselves and carry the cross and love somebody and want to be of service. See what I mean? So in general, this is true for Judaism. That rich prophetic tradition, and you look at the mainstream American Judaism, they're so assimilated, want to be Americanized, can't wait to be more materialistic, hedonistic, narcissistic. What happened to Amos? Yeah. Well, yeah, we read him when we can. You know, but we American now. Islam, same thing gonna happen. Americanization of Islam. Americanization of Buddhism. At its worst. See what I mean? But the sad thing is that prophetic black churches have usually been in the vanguard. And now many of them are losing their fervor with marketization, commercialization, and so forth, you see. And that affects leadership because the black ministers have disproportionately shaped the free-speaking, fearless-speaking leaders in the past. But now with more and more of our pastors, CEOs of their churches, it's a business operation. Mm. You know what I mean? Going to some church and see two ATMs before you see a cross. It's true. He said, what's going on?
Don't run out of money.
I want to introduce this brother. Aren't you Ernest?
Yes, sir.
This is Brother Ernest D. Diller. He was Director of Cultural Facilities Division. Let's give him a hand here. He's helped facilitate these kind of things. Struggling on the inside with dignity. Go right ahead, my brother.
Oh, no. I don't want to. No, this is your platform.
No, but just.
I'm blessed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're in all our presence, really. I appreciate you and everything that you said today. And we had a little a dialogue earlier, but I've been grappling with the legislative democracy, the republic, and the 14th Amendment issues in the corporatization of American politics and so on and so forth, and the disenfranchisement of people. And I wondered if you could help me connect those dots. Because I hear it in some of what you say all the time, but I just wanted to hear that.
No, I appreciate it. You know, there's a wonderful book called Unequal Protection.
Right.
And it tells the history of the rise of the corporation and the ways in which, at its worst, it has constituted a threat to the public life of the republic owing to the power wielded by relatively unaccountable corporate elites.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of the ironies of American history is what? The 14th Amendment was written to do what? To protect ex-slaves. 92% of the deployment of the 14th Amendment after its first 60 years was to protect corporations.
Nah.
As legal fictions.
That's right.
Which meant that when they're in trouble, they have no accountability or responsibility. That's why it's hard to get Enron's elites. That's why it's hard to get a WorldCom elites. That's why it's hard to get a Delphi elites. Because when they do something wrong, nobody can take responsibility. It's just a legal fiction. When they do something right, time to get profits, everybody lining up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how ironic that the 14th Amendment, after 620,000 fellow citizens die in the most barbaric of wars in the 19th century called American Civil War, to break the back of slaveocracy,
mm-hmm.
you get the 14th Amendment and the major deployment of it is to protect corporations. Made it difficult for workers to organize because corporations were a person who workers were just part of their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can go on and on in this regard. So your point is an important one.
Mm-hmm.
And this story is told in this book by it's by Thomas Kaufman, I think. It's called Unequal Protection.
Unequal Protection, okay.
He's an independent intellectual who lives up in Vermont. And he actually began very conservative, but he'd been fired up. He's like John Dean and all these people who've been conservative for a long time get fired up, you know. it's amazing. Look at Kevin Phillips. He's one of the most astute critics of corporate America.
Mm-hmm. Republican!
And he started off the Republican realignment in 69, but he's changed his mind. People do change. Go right ahead. Go right ahead.
First, I want to just say I absolutely adore you. And
That's kind of it, my brother. That's kind of it.
Thank you for honing all the qualities that make me feel that way. Since anyway, I since America is the first true hyperpower in the globe, and as you said, wields a disproportionate influence in every way, including democratization,
mm-hmm.
do you think it's healthier for the globe if we were to somehow diffuse that influence and denature it somewhat? Or for us to open up our public debate and wield that influence in a wiser way? And if one's more likely to occur than the other, which do you think?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question. I think it's a combination of both in this way, though, brother. That one, we have got to become more multilateral in working with other countries, not just the G8 and 7, but the Brazils and the Indias and the South Africas and others, so that we actually can form allies to attempt to ensure that our unbelievable economic might can be connected to reinforcing education, infrastructure, healthcare in those nations, along with the G7 and 8. Because you're absolutely right. I mean, as an empire, we can actually have positive influence if we take seriously our democratic traditions that put a premium on multilateral connections, international law, international courts, so that we are respected. Because you see, the thing is, I don't really mind being hated. I really don't. I mean, if I'm loving somebody and somebody still hates me, that's all right. If we are, as I said, if we're concerned about security of Israel and concerned about the justice for Palestinians and people still hate us, so what? Just because you hate me doesn't mean I'm going to give up on security for these people who've been catching hell. Just because you hate me means I'm not going to give up on their cry for justice. You can hate me, but I think I'm doing the right thing. See what I mean? But my hunch is, if America had that kind of broader conception that connected with the Brazils and Indias and so forth, the hatred would decrease. It's not ever going to be eliminated. It would decrease because we would become less hypocritical. We'd have something that we could be more proud of than just our might, our smart bombs, our collateral damage effects, and all this other ugly bureaucratic language that has to do with how people kill other people. You know what I mean? But at the same time, it doesn't mean that America just, you know, steps off the historical stage. No, it's impossible. Our destinies are too intertwined with other nations. And this is where the issue of leadership comes in. But so that it's a combination of both, because you've got to be able to still connect, still use power and clout, but in a much more humane and democratic way. Yes,
real quick, thanks. Thank you for making this free and available to everyone. I heard you speak at PCC. It's the best class I've had so far.
Pasadena City.
Yeah.
Oh, we had a good time.
Tuition was right on the money.
Yeah.
In my family's budget. I got a two-part question real quick. Me and my wife are involved on a diversity committee at our kids' school. I found we have more difficulty trying to get the adults to understand the importance of diversity. It's easier to teach our kids, I think, about it. And I wanted to know, what seeds do you think we can't overlook to plant in our kids' minds and hearts? And then trying to get attendance at these committee meetings, people think that it's everything's okay. My kids grasp so much more, I think. My wife and kids are indigenous to this country, so they understand that everything's not okay. And they're second, third, and fourth grade. How do we get people to understand that everything's not cool? We got a lot of work. Absolutely. To be passionate about it and show up to these meetings, you know?
I congratulate you and your wife for being participants in that regard. It's very important, very important. That they, I didn't get a chance too much to talk about the chapter on youth culture in the text.
Okay.
And it was a Constantinian hip-hop versus prophetic hip-hop.
Okay.
Very important. Right? Constantinian hip-hop. Misogynistic, materialistic, hedonistic, and so forth.
Okay.
Kind of get rich or die kind of orientation, you know.
I really like what you said.
And prophetic is truth-telling. Okay. Now, the thing is, we have to respect the worlds of young people and thereby see what kind of Socratic, prophetic, and tragic hope forms of reflection are taking place in their world.
Okay.
And that, I mean, hip-hop is just one major force, and it is probably one of the major cultural breakthroughs the last 30 years that came out of Chocolate Cities that affect young people, but that's just one crucial force among other forces. But we have to be in tune with that, and we have to push those progressive elements in that youth culture. And your two gifts from heaven, these are your two gifts from heaven right here, brother?
This is my oldest son.
Yes.
We've got two more at home that are younger.
Right
on. His friend.
Now let's give him a hand, though. As they come up, you get a sense of what idioms are affecting them, what languages are affecting them, and so on. Now, interesting enough, again, my point about the kind of disproportionate Afro-American influence in youth culture.
Right.
And the kind of Afro-Americanization that most youth undergo owing to music, sports, the disproportionate weight and gravity of black bodies, black intelligence, black beauty in music and sports. So you get young people speaking different languages, different orientation, disproportionately shaped by black musical forms, black cultural forms. And so the discussion becomes one of you having to educate yourself, your wife having to educate herself, along with the young people.
Right.
Now, of course, I have the same challenge myself as a Motown Philly Sound Curtis Mayfield generation kind of brother.
I really like how you've used hip-hop as a tool to kind of reel people in. And get people to understand that, you know, there's it's not just music, it's not just
exactly
I love it all. You know, I love
exactly
it all, everything from, you know, the real cerebral hip hop to the gangster rap, because I think there's a message in all of it.
Absolutely.
But you know, I think we have the tools to solve our problems, but getting people to like you're saying, step into it, step into the fire and do
energize
it.
Energize them. And the best thing is, young people would rather see a sermon any day than hear one.
Right.
And you live an example of what I'm talking about.
So I mean, how do I get people real quick to get importance? I mean.
Well, I think one is you keep doing what you're doing and you reach out.
Right.
And try to bring others along with you.
Okay.
But don't lose heart, because you are making a difference.
No,
that's
very
important to keep in mind.
I think I got, you know, I think the strength of my wife and marriage has taught me a lot. And my kids have taught me a lot. And
no, a wife will make a difference, you know. Too. But that's another subject, though, buddy.
Right.
That's a whole other subject.
Thank you for your time.
Go right ahead. Right. Yes, go right ahead.
I'm upset.
Yeah.
Okay, now you just mentioned the 14th Amendment.
Yes, I did.
Basically, you gave away the plot to Bertrand Gross, professor of Peace and Studies Department at Berkeley.
Yes, indeed.
Of good friendly fascism. Oh, what a book, right?
And I got the real book. He wrote that in the 80s.
Yeah, well.
No, they're not so loud, brother. People okay. want you to be tender.
I got a big mouth.
Yeah, that's right. Just speak tenderly. Though.
Barbara Lee gets to represent him. And you know Barbara Lee is the most courageous person in the entire Senate.
Yes, she is.
I was represented by Lee Hamilton growing up. Lee Hamilton don't represent me. You heard of Lee Hamilton lately, haven't you? 911 report, Lee Hamilton. Mm. Whitewash.
Oh, yes, I do.
Now, here's the book right here.
Dark Alliance.
Gay Webb lost his job writing this book.
Is that right? I need to read that. I don't know that text. But ask your question, though, brother.
Okay.
Are you recording yourself, though?
Propaganda. I'm recording you. You. It's on you. Hey, I start Coltrane after Ohm. You know, Ascension.
Yes.
I mean, I go for the wild stuff.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Love Supreme is just too easy. You know what I'm saying? It's just too easy.
No, it ain't too easy, brother.
Hey, Archie Shepp is where it's at.
No, this ain't a time to have a jazz discussion now, brother. But you should know that Love Supreme, not too easy. It's one of the greatest monuments of modern music, but Coltrane got so many other monuments, too. But ask your question.
His wife just came out with an album, family.
You got an album?
Alice.
You know that?
Oh, Alice. Oh, yes.
His wife
came
out.
Oh, yes.
Robbie's mom.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. The crossover point between the Berrigan brothers and the Cardinale brothers is Thomas Merton. A Cistercian monk's supposed to know enough not to talk to anybody, right? You know, up on Thomas Merton?
I read Thomas Merton.
Propagare, the Society for the Propagation of the Faith, made up the word propaganda. How much fun did you have as a resident of Massachusetts talking to your two congressmen, or your congressmen and your two senators, one of which is Kerry, right?
No, I live in Jersey, though, brother. I used to live in Massachusetts. But, I mean, I'm glad you had a chance to say something. But I think we're going to have to move along with the questions. All right? Thank you so very much. Thank you so very much.
I got 640 now, so you might want to, you want me to say just a couple.
Okay, just a few more questions here with this brother here. Thanks so much.
I have a question. A very flawed American named Thomas Jefferson once said that the prerequisite for democracy is education. And it seems that progressive people are constantly dealing with the result and not the cause. I teach school. I have 47 kids sitting in my room, sitting on the floor. It seems that there is a constant effort to dumb it down, and that George Orwell's perception of developing a newspeak where the dialogue and the intellectual endeavors that you describe, the majority of Americans are unable to enter into this dialogue. And it seems that rather than, I mean, I would like you to talk about, you know, you talked about democracy, the dialogue, intellectualization. A guy like Louis Brandeis, who is the son of immigrants, in one generation can become a Supreme Court justice. This is a phenomenon that cannot take place in America, where in Los Angeles, 92% of the whites are out of the public education system. We are creating a class society where the dialogue that you're talking about can't take place. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question, though. Appreciate the question, though. Very much so. See, one of the things that I call for is a massive shift of resources into education, healthcare, infrastructure, and so on, you see. There's three components that go along with this. One, you need the resources to make it a priority. That includes salaries of teachers like yourself and others. People have a sense that you are important based on even market criteria as well as citizenship criteria. Second thing is those communities from which the students come have to have some backbone. Because even after you've given your all in the classroom, if they're going back into a community that is devastated, it's going to be difficult for them to sustain their imaginations in the way in which one would like. But thirdly is their own structures of motivation. And there we have to deal with the market. We got to deal with TV, we got to deal with film, we got to deal with video, and so forth and so on. That's something outside of your control, and that's something even outside of the parents' control. That's something that has to do with corporate America. Corporate America is targeting young people as a bundle of desires to become consumers that puts very little weight on being a citizen. And public education is a pillar for citizenship, just like rule of law, right, in a democracy.
But the targeting is it only works if you dumb it down so there's no analytic skills. My students don't have analytic skills. They don't shop. They don't shop ideas. They don't shop what they buy. Those are critical skills that are wholly missing in our society at this point.
But see, I mean, that's part of the critical thinking that I was talking about. And I think, in fact, that you take a CD like College Dropout, Kanye West. It's number one hit for a little while, right? You look at the level of critical reflection in that CD sells by the millions, that generates a discussion, even in classrooms, you know, as well as outside on the streets. So that the question, how then do you tease out that kind of critical energy that you and I are after as teachers, exactly, in that particular form? Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge for us. Because the dumbing down is real, but of course the dumbing down is for adults, middle age, old age, young, right across the board. That's what the whole culture is about. And the question is, how do we both sustain it, and how do we find the critical manifestations in the younger generation in their idiom? And I do think that even though the dumbing down is real, there are certain analytical critical skills still being deployed in very different ways in different contexts where we ourselves are not really in connection with, because they have given up on us.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
The
schoolroom and so forth. But yeah, you and I want to be in on it. As you see the point I'm making. I won't go on and on, but congratulations on the work you're doing, though, man.
Thank you.
Question. I'm sorry to go on and on. I know it's getting late. Go right ahead, though, brother.
Good evening.
How you doing there, man?
My name is Cirilo Juarez, and I'm actually a member of the Bus Riders Union, and I want to tell you, Cornell, you're dynamite. I have heard some speakers, because, you know, I haven't been out politically that much. Mm-hmm. I am so grateful to have heard you, and I also want to acknowledge everybody else that's here and the variety of people that are here. I think it's wonderful.
Let me just
add this, please, and just bear with me for a minute. At the Bus Riders Union, because we are able to now, we incorporate three languages, English, Español, and Korean. I would like to know if anybody here would have brought Spanish-speaking people but didn't, because translation was not offered.
Or if it was, I have no idea.
Yeah. Let me just say one more thing, please. It'll be really fast. I want your opinion or your suggestion with regard to the migration of people from the South, meaning, you know, all of those what you might call Latin American countries, and how migrants are vilified, and how that pits us against one another when really we should be all fighting the corrupt system and this government of imperialism and racism. Please, mm-hmm, how would you address that?
Well, I think you said it, though, brother. I mean, the thing is, as you know, it's more easily said than done in terms of how you overcome some of those very deep fissures and schisms. But you've got to have someone like yourself and others who are intent on the vision of overcoming these deep divisions. When I look at, for example, one of the most important movements right now on the globe is the anti-sweatshop movement. And, of course, L.A. has played a very important role, Las Vegas, Asia, Italy, Turkey, and other places. But one of the things you have to have in that kind of movement is what? A vision that somehow allows persons to be able to go across certain kinds of lines of demarcation. And they go over not just based solely on interest, even though they want to be able to both survive and thrive, but also based on a vision. And vision is not a vision thing. That's the commodification of vision that the Elder Bush put forward. The vision allows people to do things that they ordinarily would not want to do, but they believe they can do owing to a vision that lures them and appeals to the better angels of their nature. You have to have some vision working along with the will and the courage. So that's just a brief footnote to what you had already said in terms of what is needed. The question is trying to do it on the ground. The trade union movement has been at its best, been able to do it at its worst. It's fallen into xenophobic traps, too.
Again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's get one more question.
Mr. President, I'll be real quick. I'm a Irish African-American son of a grandson of a sharecropper. Now, I call home today because I heard you on the radio yesterday speaking on Uprising.
Oh,
all right.
Okay. Yeah.
I was really excited I was going to get out to see you. Now, I called and spoke to my brother who was 19, and he said he asked me who you were. And I felt like jumping to the phone and strangling him. Now, what my question is that I consider myself part of the Socratic hip-hop generation.
Right on.
My brother is definitely part of the Constantinian hip-hop generation.
There
are only 7 years that separate us.
All right.
All right. And my question is, if in my own family, when I have great dialogue with both of my parents, when I have great dialogue with both of my brothers, there is a definite disconnect as far as the need to be active as far as American politics, as far as American race is concerned. Mm-hmm. And if there's a schism in my family, then I am not surprised at the gap that exists in culture.
Right.
And what I want to know is that because the black family is the source of strength in our community, where is it that folks like myself who feel as if we have to get involved, but we also have to find a way to make ends meet, because, you know, politics doesn't pay money when you're 26. You know, it just doesn't do it. You know, so feeling that kind of a need to make a difference and also needing to eat at the same time, how is it that we get involved and make sure that we keep fighting right now?
No, I appreciate the question, though, brother. Definitely. And appreciate your commitment to prophetic hip-hop, too. Because I know KRS-One, who was here for a good while and been my dear brother. In fact, he's one of the epigraphs in my chapter on youth. He and Chuck D are the two figures who I begin with epigraph because they prophetic.
Right.
In a historic sense, right?
Right.
And yet, every generation has to generate their own new voices, even by learning from the KRS-One's and others, right? But I think the crucial thing is this, because you got one life to live, though, man. You want to first raise the question that, you know, what is my real calling and vocation? What's my passion? Because you owe it to yourself for that. Now, if you answer that question, let's say the way Coltrane would, I got to blow my horn,
yeah,
or I'll go crazy.
I play sax, too, man.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Then you got self-knowledge. And you say, okay, whatever it takes, I've got to pursue this passion, but I also got loved ones, right? I'm only a child. I got a mama. My father died when he was 17. I got to take care of her. Naomi, she's taking care of Naima taking care of me. I'm taking care of her. So you got practical consideration, but the practical considerations sit alongside what your calling is. Only you can answer that question in the precincts of your own soul. Then the question becomes, you got to hook up with other folk who are open to your calling and your practical concerns. You got to be part of a community, a network. Sometimes it's just two or three. I was just with Brother Andre of Outkast. And 15 years ago, they just, in the projects, people laughing at him and stuff. But they had that commitment, passion, and discipline to keep persevering and enduring, you see. And then they take off, you see. Now, in addition to that, there's a political dimension, which means you also want to be organized. Because the thing is, it can't be political and unorganized. You end up with a political mind, but I have no connection whatsoever to any institution, movement, and what have you. So you want to be organized. So all of these are elements that you have to keep together in your own life, along with, you know, the loved ones who support you and your particular family, as you say. And the family comes from a variety of different cultures and so forth and so on, because only you have the voice that you have, and only you can bring that unique voice to bear. But your voice will only develop over against other voices, just like a jazz quintet, a quartet. It's over against for the greater good, you see. So that's not a real answer, because I can't answer the question. It's a framing of the question that I hope in some way might humbly enable you to answer that, because there's no doubt that you got much to contribute, man. Absolutely. Got much to contribute. Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
Good evening, Professor West. I'm Heather Davis. I'm the niece of Howard McGarry.
Yes,
and I haven't seen you since I was touring law school.
We should tell Howard McGarry is a towering philosopher. He's a black brother, taught at Rutgers now for over 30 years, and he comes from Los Angeles.
Yes.
From
and
Los
sisters
Angeles.
Are here, too.
He's my dear brother, too.
What but my question is, there's much in the press now about the war records of the presidential candidates, but my contemporaries from Yale and Columbia and the other Ivies, and I'm sure you see this with your students, did not serve in the military. And people in the generation behind me, I'm sure that they will not be serving in the military because, as you mentioned, there's a certain class of people who are serving in the military now. Yes. So in 4 years from now, when people from my generation can run for president, do you think that service in the military will be an issue or not as much of an issue? And I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, it's hard to say. Yeah. It depends in part on what the situation is then. Right. I mean, if we're locked into another war, then it could easily surface. You see what I mean? It depends on what the response will be regarding Iraq in the next 2, 4, 6, 8 years. Right? If another Vietnam, we're there for a long time, it's going to be massive division in the country. If somehow we can withdraw international troops, allow for stability, then that issue may not arise in an
because
election.
Because even during times
road.
Of peace, though, it seems that it's still an issue. It seems that voters still want to know whether the candidate has served in the military.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's true. Usually because the United States tends to be militaristically involved almost every 4 years or so somewhere in the world.
Right.
And so it becomes difficult for there to be full wholesale peace to see what an election looks like in such a context.
Right.
But I appreciate the question, though.
You're welcome. Thank
yeah,
you for
good
coming.
To see you, though,
you
too.
Too.
Yeah, the McGarry family, very special family. Yes, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. West. Thanks for coming tonight. Thanks for having us. I want
to
ask you something.
Yes.
I'm going to ask the end of the question first, and then I'm going to back up, okay? I live in the most conservative area in California. I live in San Diego.
In San Diego?
Yes, I do. I guess that makes me the enemy, okay?
No. San Diego.
My question is, how do I get Cornel West to come to San Diego? Because a progressive voice is one that we need down there. Now, I'm going to give you a little history. I'm a Bronx boy, okay?
Right on.
And I was lucky enough to live in a very safe New York City, just like L.A. is safe, because we're all progressives. I lived in PG County, Maryland for 10 years before I moved to San Diego last year. I've never lived in a conservative bastion like I live now. How do we get the Michael Moores, the Cornel West, the progressive voices, the Pacifica Radio? How do we get that to come to San Diego and not preach to the choir? I mean, because this is real safe, you know, but everyone in L.A. loves you already. You did?
Well, not everybody I mean, a lot of people in Los Angeles, okay. But not everybody. No.
A simple
question. But I mean, I hear what you're saying.
How do we
but
get
one,
this
one thing is, I just appreciate you being here. But, I mean, I've been to San Diego many, many times now, brother. Sometimes under police escort, but I've been there. And would love to come again. We just talk. I gave my number, you know, right after.
Okay. Right.
But, no, I'd love to. But it's not just a matter of the voices coming in. There's a number of progressive persons like yourself in San Diego who are cutting against the grain, who persons like myself can learn something from, as well as come and bring some kind of insight and energy. So it's a mutual reciprocal kind of thing. And wherever one goes, no matter if it's a conservative bastion, you're usually going to find some Socratic, prophetic, progressive folk doing some things. No doubt about that.
Sure.
And I have found that when I've gone to San Diego. It was a La Mesa school. I forget the exact name of, you know, the Catholic school there.
Okay.
I did a community center there. Of course, they got that beautiful museum where I've done some lectures on art and jazz and so forth and so on. And some progressive folk have come from San Diego.
Charles McPherson's down there, and you're right. I mean, there are some of us who are there,
absolutely.
But we're in the minority. I'm going to be at the book signing. I got my copy, so we will.
But no, we'll exchange numbers right now.
Thank you, Dr. West. I appreciate that.
But I think we're going to have to bring it to you.